Mr. Hewitt, may I have a motion to approve the minutes from January 12, 2023?
Madam Chair, so moved.
Thank you. Vice Chair Hewitt moves the approval of the minutes from January 12, 2023. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please say aye or aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes of January 12th are approved. The first item, we have a busy agenda today, so we'll just keep moving. The first item before us is House File 29, appropriating money to the Office of the Attorney General to provide legal services for violent crimes and financial exploitation. We have a bill for consideration, House File 29. Representative Hewitt, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
Madam Chair, I would. Yes, I would.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt moves House File 29 to be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means. There is an author's amendment, the DE2. Representative Hewitt, would you like to move that amendment before us?
Madam Chair, I would.
All right. Thank you. Representative Hewitt moves the DE2.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If the author would explain the differences between his underlying bill and the DE2, that would be, I believe, custom and usage of our committee in the House.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt, would you like to speak to the DE2?
Madam Chair, I would. Very simply, the DE2 simply adds more money to the bill to get the to start the program this year instead of putting it off. This is an urgent matter, and we need to move on it.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Nash.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. To the author, I also noticed that on line 1.12, I believe that there are some deletions pertaining to serious offenses coming out of the bill. Can you explain what you intended when you put serious offenses in and why you're removing it now?
Madam Chair, I would like to, if we're going to get into this now, I'd like to bring up the AG's office because they assisted on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Attorney General Ellison, would you like to join Representative Hewitt at the testifying table? Attorney General Ellison.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Hewitt and Representative Nash, I would like to ask to hear the question again. I'm not sure that I understood it when I heard it, although I am listening intently. Maybe it was sound or something like that.
Thank you, Attorney General. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Attorney General Ellison, in line 1.12 of the underlying bill before it would be amended, so it is as it sits today. There is now a proposed removal of the prosecution of serious offenses. And I was just trying to figure out why that might be.
Madam
Attorney
Chair,
General Ellison.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, we at the Attorney General's office only prosecute serious offenses on behalf of counties. If I may remind the committee, Minnesota Statute 8.01, which was passed by a previous state legislature, is the law that kind of governs how cases come to the Attorney General's office, with the exception of Medicaid fraud cases, which are a whole other category. But in the normal course, when counties need our assistance, they contact us. And if we have resources available, we step up and handle those cases with them or for them based on how they would like to proceed. In the 4 years that I've been at the Attorney General's office, we've handled overwhelmingly homicide cases. We've had some criminal sexual conduct cases. We recently took in a shaken baby case where an infant survived the encounter but was severely injured, and the county asked us to step in because there's some complex medical evidence that will be introduced. So the fact is we never do low-level cases. We never do fifth-degree controlled substance cases. We never do low-level theft cases. All we ever do are very serious felony cases for which the defendant is facing quite a serious consequence. I yield back.
Thank you, Attorney General. Representative Nash.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just trying to ascertain the differences because the morphology of the bill has changed on the author's DE amendment. In line 1.9, it's picking up, it says, from general fund to the Attorney General for enhanced criminal enforcement and related initiatives. You compare that to line 1.12, and it says necessary assistance with county prosecution of serious offenses. They're two different pieces of language, and I'm just trying to figure out what's changed. Because when you came to my office last week and to sell me on the bill, I understood this to not only be perhaps criminal cases, but also things like waste, fraud, and abuse, and other initiatives. And I'm just trying to figure out, and I don't have a copy of Black's Law Dictionary, but only if we had maybe a lawyer that could help us out with the definitional differences here. I'm trying to figure out why the change in language.
Attorney General.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, I think it essentially is a drafting issue. It has nothing to do with the content or substance of anything we've been asking for. We were working on very serious felonies. We are working on very serious felonies. There simply is no content difference between what we were asking for and what we are asking for now. So I think that it probably has something to do with the way something was drafted at one point, but it has there is no, and I will represent there to the entire committee that there is no content difference. I will say that we are asking for some money earlier when we introduced before. I think the money was in the next fiscal year. We could actually there are counties who've contacted us very recently, and we want to be able to meet their needs right away. So we've asked for some money earlier so that we can get started. But I would say that it probably lies in some sort of reviser drafting matter, and so that's it. I'll yield back.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
One moment, please. Well,
Madam Chair, if I could,
Mr. Gehring would like to speak to the language, please, Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash. So I think the reason why the DE2 is drafted the way it is because this is language that appeared in the state government bill last year, so it's tracking the same rider kind of structure that has appeared before. So I think I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to remind our members that our nonpartisan staff, I never attribute something that is a change to them. It is at the purview of and direction of the author. So I wanted to make sure that we made sure that that was on the record, that we did not say, the drafting change was because of the reviser's office. It is at the direction of the author through the reviser's office, a very notable change. So thank you, Madam Chair. Last question for this before we vote on it, if I might.
I'm sorry, would you please repeat that statement?
If I could ask one more question.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the author or to the Attorney General, so I just wanted to make sure we're on the record that because even though there is some language changes, this money will still be going to not only be prosecuting, I believe, violent crime, but also waste, fraud, and abuse?
Attorney General Ellison.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash. So under Minnesota Statute 8.01, which was passed by the state legislature, it doesn't limit the kind of case. So if you look at the language of the statute, it simply says when a county attorney wants to seek the assistance of the Attorney General, they may do so. Now our practice is to only take the most serious cases because, quite honestly, our staff isn't big enough to take low-level crimes. There have been cases that I think there's one case that was a misdemeanor level, but it was an environmental crime. And so that had some complicated science involved. So we worked with our colleagues there to get that done. But that was the only one. All the other cases have been very serious in terms of the amount of time that the defendant was facing. So to answer your question, yes, we can certainly do waste, fraud, and abuse prosecutions. But let me just remind the committee, we can't do anything unless the county says we need this help. Now, I will say that a few years ago, this body passed a wage theft law that has criminal components. If we were asked we certainly would review the matter and if we and help any way that we could. We are concerned. We are very concerned about things like sex and labor trafficking. These things cross county lines often. It would be beneficial for the county to the state to be able to assist in those ways.
Thank you, Attorney General Ellison. I'm just going to, it's normal practice for us to get the bill in the shape that the author would want. We're not really discussing the merits of the underlying bill at this moment. So if we could just please have a vote on adoption of the DE2 to put the bill in the condition that the author would want. I'm going to call the vote on the DE2. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
No.
All those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is now in the condition of the author's request. Now, we can discuss the bill, the DE2.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Did you want to move that other amendment?
Now that we have the bill in the order that you want, we can discuss the other amendment. We do have another amendment. Who is authoring the A2?
That would be me, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash, to the A2, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as a preface, the author's DE amendment was significantly different, and I believe that there was a worthy conversation to be had there, and that mm-hmm. was why my side actually had other questions before you forced the vote, because you're asking us to vote on something that is significantly different. It would be, again, custom and usage of our body to ask questions of something, even though you may want to put it in the form that the author so chooses. So I will move the A2. The A2 is an amendment that would require the submission of a report onto the efficacy of the money that is being appropriated. I believe at time of drafting, and we may have to go back and amend this to reflect the increase that Representative Hewitt just mentioned, but it's essentially asking for a report on how effective was the appropriation of this money as to the number of crimes prosecuted and judgments found. So I think that I would hope that Representative Hewitt would recognize this as a friendly amendment, because if we're going to spend money, we should, you know, have those silly pedestrian ideas of measuring how we did as we appropriate money. And I would request a roll call.
A roll call having been requested, we will have a roll call. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Representative Nash and Madam Chair. Looking at that, again, it seems very general, and it seems like you went towards a specific area there. So I would recommend a no vote on the amendment.
Thank you.
And
Representative Nadeau, did you have a question that you wanted to ask?
Not on this amendment.
Thank you. Representative Bonner.
Just briefly, thank you, Attorney General Ellison, for being here. I think recently we actually saw a report that outlined all of the cases that your office handled, and it also addressed the outcomes of those cases. It was not specific to fraud, waste, and abuse, but rather an overall full view of all of the cases that have run through your office. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair.
Attorney General Ellison.
Representative Boehner, you are absolutely correct. It's called the 8.15 report. It's an annual report. It's statutorily required. We issue a report every year. Additional reporting requirements for this money would not add to the knowledge, wisdom, information that is already available.
Thank you, and I would like to remind the audience and the committee members that A15 report was posted to the committee's agenda today. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm disappointed that Representative Hewitt has decided to pursue the deflection of this. We're being asked to come into committee early in the session with a sense of urgency to appropriate new money for the Attorney General's office. I think that the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota would like to understand, what level of accountability and return that this money is going to yield, because it's not just 2.021. It's, that is a one-year number, but the biennial number is $4,042,000. That's not an insignificant amount of money, Madam Chair, and I think that it is not untoward of us to ask for a report for something that is being fast-tracked. And I chose waste, fraud, and abuse because there have been some fairly high-profile cases of waste, fraud, and abuse that have come to the Attorney General's office that did not come out on the affirmative, as he claims on a regular basis. He doesn't lose. He was engaged by the Department of Education for a case of waste, fraud, and abuse, and that wound up not being settled by his office. The money had to be returned, and I think that there is a bevy of questions that the average taxpayer would like to ask, and I think a report would be a very good use of that time.
Attorney General Ellison, would you like to comment?
Yeah, Chair Cleburne, Representative Nash, this matter that you're referring to has a lot of facts associated with it, which I would be very happy to discuss with anyone. But the main thing that's important to understand, if this was federal money and the case was prosecuted by the United States Attorney's Office successfully, over 50 indictments, many people have already pled guilty or been or about to be found guilty, and people are being held accountable. As soon as fraud came to our attention through this program, which was not Minnesota money, it was federal money, it was the source of it was from the federal government. We alerted the U.S. attorney, the federal authorities, cooperated with them, and obtained indictments, and those people are being prosecuted right now. So it's simply, so what we're talking about today and that issue, are they couldn't be more apples and oranges. They're simply different. And we wouldn't prosecute those cases in any case because it's federal money violating the federal statute on a federal program, and it is appropriate for the federal authorities to prosecute those cases. I yield back.
Thank you, Attorney General. We have three members who are asking for
questions. I hadn't quite finished,
Madam. One more, please, and then I'll move to the next representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Attorney General Ellison, I do appreciate the fact that you say that you're willing to talk to anybody. I would imagine that you also would speak to Representative Kreisha, who on November 2nd of 2022 sent your office a fairly detailed letter, and we have extra copies if you need one. Again, asking you a long number of detailed questions. As I understand it, Attorney General Ellison, the money that was sent to your office as a retainer to defend the Department of Education was Minnesota money, not federal money. And I just think, again, back to the underlying amendment that I'm trying to put onto the bill, we're asking for a level of accountability that because you are asking for money in an expeditious manner, we are also asking for something that is perhaps outside of your norm. But I also know that it is not a crazy idea to say, let's see how it does. You know, in the private sector, we have Six Sigma and Lean and Kaizen. If we're going to give something some capital and we're going to put something behind it, we should measure it to see if it's being successful. And I think that a report is a very fine way to do that. So, you know, and as to the being willing to speak with anybody, I would strongly urge you to reach back out to Representative Kreisha because that letter is now quite old.
Representative Nash, if you have a letter that you're going to reference in committee, I would ask that you please make sure that all members have it and that we have it in advance.
Yep.
If this is an old letter, certainly you would have had time to submit it. We would have had time to review it, and then we could have a full discussion about that letter. We're going
to
move on. The next representative, Representative Joy, to your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Say a couple questions. I'm a new freshman to the legislator representing up northwest Minnesota. What is the metric for success for the Attorney General's office? Question one. Number two, what measurable outcomes does the additional funding hope to achieve?
Attorney General Ellison, if you'll keep this brief, we did have an overview of your office earlier where this question could have also have been asked. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The outcomes are representing the people of the state of Minnesota, representing the agencies of the state of Minnesota, and serving on various boards. The office of the Attorney General's office is in the Constitution of the state of Minnesota. It's a constitutional office, and the people who frame the Constitution of the state, like all of the other states, viewed the importance of the Attorney General's office as important. It dates back from till the 11th century in England. It's a very old traditional office, and it's to represent the people of the area and the agencies of that operate in the state of government. I believe your other question is an interesting one. I mean, so when someone is murdered or robbed or killed or raped, what we do as a civilized society is we hold those people accountable. The measure of success is whether we identify the people who committed the act, whether we hold them accountable within the Constitution, and whether we give them appropriate sentence for their conduct. That is really the measure of success. It's interesting because achieving justice for victims is not a matter of profit and loss. It's a matter of human beings suffering and having some level of accountability from their government. I yield back.
Thank you, Attorney General. The next question is from Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Attorney General Keith Ellison. I know that your office has actually done quite a bit. I'm just curious as to, I think you might have provided this information already, but how much has your office saved the state of Minnesota?
Attorney General.
Madam Chair, I think the last number we had was well over $1 billion when you add up everything. Mm-hmm. We certainly return far more value to the state than we actually draw from the state coffers. So, and again, you know, to a certain extent, it's not even, it can't be measured easily in a dollars and cents, because if you're the parent of someone or the child of someone, one of the cases that we had involved a former Minnesota Viking, Barry Bennett, and his wife, who were murdered by their child. To the siblings of that family, if you try to talk about the value that the attorney general brought by prosecuting that case, it simply does not fit in on a balance sheet very well. It's like we needed to know that the person who took everything from us is standing in account for that. And so that's my best answer to you. Yeah, in dollars and cents, over $1 billion. In terms of people's sense that there's justice done, I don't think that that's a calculable number.
Thank you, Attorney General. I would like to just remind us, Representative Kosnick, you have a question, but I just want to remind everyone we are discussing the merits of the A2 amendment. Thank you. This will be the last question before we call the vote.
Madam Chair, can I just real quick? I just want to say, Madam
Representative
Chair,
Attorney
General Keith Ellison, thank you so much. And as somebody who comes from a for-profit, the private sector, and does no balance sheet and does no return investment, this is for the amount that is being asked, it is a phenomenal return on investment, and we appreciate the work that your office has done. And we also understand that as people from marginalized communities, we feel like this is the first time our voices have been heard in the cases that you are taking on and what you're taking on very seriously, and want to make sure that this committee understands the difference in the work that you have done versus other attorney generals in this space. Even though our attorney generals always do a great job, you have done a phenomenal job in ensuring that the community is represented and the issues that impact us from the diverse communities is also lifted up and worked on, and the return on the investment on this is enormous. Appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative
Chair. Thank you, Representative Herr.
Representative Kosnick.
Well, I appreciate you recognizing me, Madam Chair, but in fact, I did not have a question. Maybe I was helping Representative Joy get recognized.
Thank you so much. Representative Hewitt to the A2.
I just recommend a no vote.
Thank you. A roll call having been requested, the CLA will please take the roll.
Chair Cleavorn?
No.
Cleavorn, no. Vice Chair Hewitt?
No.
Hewitt, no. Lead Nash?
Yes, please.
Nash, aye. Representative Bonner?
No.
Bonner, no. Representative Berg?
No.
Berg, no. Representative Freiberg?
No.
Freiberg, no. Representative Hansen?
No.
Hansen, no. Representative Harder?
Yes.
Harder, aye. Representative Herr?
No.
Herr, no. Representative Joy?
Aye.
Joy, aye. Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Kosnick, aye. Representative Nadeau?
Aye.
Nadeau, aye. Representative Newton?
No.
Newton, no. Madam Chair, that's 5 ayes and 8 nays.
With a vote of 5 ayes and 8 nays, the motion does not prevail. The A2 is not adopted. Representative Hewitt, to the underlying bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. Good discussions earlier here. The reason I was happy to help with this bill was One of the projects everybody knows from this committee that I'm working on is emergency medical services, which is a portion of public safety. And what I'm running into is in the rural areas that there is no funding, period. You go to the counties, you go to the places where they get their money, and they're just the pump is dry. And it's real hard out there to do anything with public safety or EMS or fire. And this was a total afterthought of what do they do in the prosecutor's office when they got to deal with the bad people. So I was really receptive to this. I'm really happy. I also have had the AG work in my own area a couple times for some bad players out there, and they've done a fantastic job. And it's not always to the prosecution level. It's to maybe give a little reminder here and there. So I'm real happy to carry this. And this bill is firmly about public safety and getting the bad guy and using the state's largest law office to take care of that when our own counties cannot afford to do it at this time.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. One moment, please. Would you like for your testifier now or after questions?
I think we move forward to questions. I think we covered a lot of stuff already. So,
perfect. Thank you very much. Representative Harder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, you mentioned about counties were looking for help on some of these cases. Well, I did reach out. I live in the rural area. I did reach out to attorneys in my district. And one of the responses that came back was that we are capable of handling matters ourselves and are not in need of the Attorney General's assistance. I was basically asking, how often do you reach out for assistance? And that particular county attorney.
Thank you. We do have Robert Small here from he is the executive director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Mr. Small, if you would like to address the question, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I am sorry I did not hear the full question. I should identify myself first. My name is Robert Small. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association.
Representative Harder, if you'd like to briefly restate your question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Robert Small. So if it was a question, so I had reached out to a couple of the county attorneys that are in my district questioning how often do you reach out to the Attorney General's office for assistance. And one of them did respond back saying that that they do not, rarely, or I should say rarely, and that they are capable of handling what comes before them on their own. So I just question the letter that you had sent about all the counties that are using this assistance. Do we have any data as to how often counties are reaching out for your assistance? Help me understand. I mean, if you have the data when counties are reaching out, I would like to see that, please.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Mr. Small.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Harder. I do not have the data. The Attorney General might have the data. What I can say is there are other letters from other county attorneys. I'm not sure, Madam Representative Harder, which district you're from, so I'm not sure which counties you're talking about. But the Attorney General might have some information about how often we do that.
Thank you, Attorney General.
Madam Chair, Representative Harder, I'd just like to share with you that we do have a criminal division of the Minnesota Attorney General's office, and in the past 3 years, with the prosecutors that we have, we've made charging decisions and prosecuted 33 cases of murder, manslaughter, vehicular homicide, criminal sexual conduct at the request of county attorneys. We haven't lost any of those cases. Our office, by the way, 18 of the 20 counties where the criminal division has handled these matters are in greater Minnesota. So there are 87 counties. It is possible that 100% of them have not called us, but I can tell you that we have received calls in 20 counties, and I think it's a good thing that you haven't had a lot of calls, because that means there weren't that many murders, you know, and so that's probably not a bad thing, but I think it's a good thing that we're there and available. If they want to call us, we're more than happy to help. I yield back.
Thank you very much. Representative Nadeau, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hewitt, for bringing this up. This is important. As we, you know, violent crime is up there, and I'm glad that we're looking at this. My questions have to do with the office itself. I wanna start there. What your criminal division you've mentioned a couple of times. Can you give me the ballpark numbers on the number of lawyers you have and investigators in the criminal division, and then compare that to consumer protection, for example? That's been a big focus, way even before you. I mean, you know, Attorney General Hatch kind of brought that up years and years ago. Can you give me just a better understanding of those two divisions and the lawyers in those and the investigators in those and the focus of your office?
I would like to remind the committee that we are discussing the bill before us, and please I'll ask that when we're wording our questions to make sure that they're relevant to the bill. But I do appreciate this question, and I will permit it. H.G. Ellison, please.
Madam Chair, the Consumer Division is substantially larger than our trial court prosecution group. Our Consumer Division is one that handles everything from antitrust matters to consumer fraud to all kinds of things, and it is substantially larger. When I got the Attorney General's office, there was one full-time trial court level prosecutor. There were more prosecutors who did appellate work, and there were more prosecutors than that did involuntary commitments for sexually dangerous predators. And then, of course, we have a whole division that does implied consent, which is when people on the roadway commit a DUI, for example. It's not just a criminal matter. It's also a civil matter in terms of their license. So that's in our criminal division, too. We've now gone up to three full-time criminal prosecutors. We have more people than that who will take a case. But in terms of people who that's all they do and they do it well, we started with one. Now we have three. And we're at the point where if we move that up, we're going to lose on other end. And I mention that to you because it is public safety that consumer lawyers do. They're the ones, the consumer lawyers are the ones who have returned millions of dollars back for the opioid cases, for example. In one case, they got $290 million. Another one, we're working on one that has $235 million. This money will go to treatment. This money will go to help people get well. But also, wage theft, that's a criminal in nature. And then also the work we've done with in housing. We know housing is good, solid housing keeps people out of the space of the criminal justice system. So the consumer fraud stuff is not exclusive from public safety, but it's not criminal prosecution either.
Thank you, Attorney General.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I am going directly.
Excuse me, Representative Nadeau. I'm going to ask you to wrap up because we have some time constraints this morning. Representative Hewitt is being requested in another committee as well, so we need to make sure that we have the vote on the bill, and I want to give Lead Nash time to wrap up.
Okay. So this goes directly to the spending in this bill, Madam Chair.
Then please ask.
You know, what I'm trying to determine is whether or not consumer protection attorneys can be moved into criminal. I mean, and maybe they don't have that background, but is there no efficiencies in that office where, you know, the focus has been on consumer protection almost exclusively? I mean, your own testimony says you've got three lawyers doing this work. And I'm assuming that there's, you know, a significantly higher number of consumer protection attorneys. How is it that we can come at this point and say, you know what, our focus needs to be criminal, but we don't have any lawyers, we need more money, rather than looking at the efficiencies in the office to find that?
Thank you, Representative Nadeau, and I'd like to remind that this is not the first time you've made this request. And I'd like to thank Representative Hewitt and you, AG, for being persistent in making sure that violent crime is addressed in our state. Please, would you give a brief response so that we can move on to Lead Nash?
Madam Chair, the Attorney General's office representative is supposed to do, we have statutorily required
to work on certain things. The statutes passed by the legislature require us to work on residential utilities. That's in the consumers. Require us to work on charities matters. That's in the statutes. Require us to work in the area of consumer. And the Minnesota Statute 8.01, you know, says that the counties can come to us when they need help. They need help. That's why the executive director of the counties is here. And so the real issue is that we have seen in the last 20 years essentially a flat line in terms of nominal dollars and a significant reduction in terms of real dollars in the last 20 years. And so we used to simply do more than we used to do because we have more to do it with. We've not done anything to meet the, you know, litigation is more complicated. The population of the state has increased, and yet the budget of the AG's office is not. So that's really where it comes from. And, you know, on this issue of efficiency, I just want to let you know, you're right. We should always look for efficiencies. Actually, Representative Nash and I had a good conversation about that. But when a victim is saying, my loved one was murdered, it's just very difficult to say, we would love to help you, but, you know, it's just not in the budget. So, I mean, we've got to respond to that. You know, this is, if we were talking about light fixtures and stuff like that or road costs, yeah, absolutely more efficient. We're talking about justice. I think it's a little different. I yield back.
Thank you, Attorney General. Lead Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. To the author of the bill and to the Attorney General, I'm not denying that there are needs from a prosecutorial perspective. I do recognize that there are a fair amount of bad actors out there in both the murder, but also waste, fraud, and abuse. And you know, I'm trying to get to the bottom of the value that we're going to be able to impart to the people of the state of Minnesota, with whom your office is funded with their money. And I don't think anybody disagrees with that. My problem is that wouldn't listen to the amendment, wouldn't listen to the argument, and you know, the $500 million that was sent to engage on behalf of Feeding Our Future. I hope that you can provide better value than you did with that. I'm still curious as to how much of that was spent on lawyers' fees internally before it was sent back to the DOE, because that's all Minnesotans' money. It's not yours, not mine. It belongs to the people who populate the state around us. But I have deep concerns about this. I am looking forward to another full-throated conversation once this makes it to Ways and Means. I will be voting no on this because there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of interest in working together on this. Came with an honest amendment that was offered in good faith. That was rejected, and as a result of that, we'll have more full-throated conversations. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and Representative Hewitt, if you'll quickly wrap up.
Madam Chair, I would request a roll call on the underlying bill.
A roll call has been requested.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, and thank you, Lead Nash, for the spirit of the debate. And as we go forward, I look forward to your comments. Madam Chair, I'd like to move to a vote.
Thank you. And with no further discussion, Representative Hewitt, you renew your motion to recommend House File 29 as amended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Will the CLA please take the vote?
Chair Cleavorn.
Aye.
Cleavorn, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Nash.
Nope.
Nash, no. Representative Bonner.
Adley, yes.
Bonner, aye. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Hansen.
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Harder.
No.
Harder, no. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Herr, aye. Representative Joy.
No.
Joy, no. Representative Kosnick.
No.
Kosnick, no. Representative Nadeau.
No.
Nadeau, no. Representative Newton.
Aye.
Newton, aye. Madam Chair, that's 8 ayes and 5 nays.
Thank you. The ayes have it. The motion prevails. House File 29, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, committee.
Next, we will have a presentation from the Secretary of State's office. I would like to remind the committee and the audience present today that we have the Secretary of State before us, but the elections part of his office is not in our jurisdiction, and I'll ask that the testimony and the questions please refer to those items within our jurisdiction. And with that, Secretary of State, if you'll identify yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Thank you for the opportunity to present on the work of the Office of Secretary of State. As you requested, Madam Chair, this is an overview. We'll be together again and have time, I'm sure, for more granular discussions on a lot of issues. We have a presentation. I hope you have it before you. And I think it's presenting electronically as well. So with me today, I should point out, is our Director of Government Relations, Nicole Freeman. So please get to know her. Many of you know her already, and surely you'll get to know her. Thank you.
Members, the presentation is in your packets.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Well, the initial thing I'd like to mention, Madam Chair and members, is the acknowledgement that the first thing that most people think of when they think of our office is elections. But the largest portion of our office is not elections. The largest portion of our office is actually the Business Services and Central IT Division. And for that reason, we are a small profit center for the state. Do I have the right?
Nope.
Okay, that's the right one. Okay. So our office, as I never hesitate to mention, basically makes $27 million more than we cost. So if you add up every person, every paperclip, everything in our office, we generate for the state $27 million more than that. So we're a small profit center. Our business services division, which includes office IT, makes up, as you'll see, nearly 60% of our resource allocation and is the most common point of contact every day between the Secretary of State's office and the people of Minnesota. Our elections division, as you'll see, is the next largest division, and then we have administration and, of course, the Safe at Home program. As the largest division in the office, I'll start with an overview of the business division. The business services division provides many services to Minnesotans, especially those within the business community. That includes business owners, chambers of commerce, economic development authorities, and others. So we like to say that we're the welcome mat for Minnesota businesses. As many of you know from personal experience, the very first thing that someone will do typically when they start a business, before they hire someone, before they get office space, before they get a license or permit, is make the actual entity come alive legally. And that's what you do through the Office of Secretary of State. Our Business Services Division also records documents filed under the Uniform Commercial Code, or UCC, regarding collateral pledged to secure loans, administers the central notification system, known as CNS, for farm product liens, and files and maintains the statewide federal tax liens. In 2022, the office processed over 90,000 new business filings and over 640,000 total business filings. The office also provides the Minnesota Business Services Snapshot, which is a voluntary survey of businesses so that the business community and others can identify partners within the state and the public can receive more information about the types of businesses within Minnesota. These are the five voluntary questions that businesses can answer to help provide further information about the types of business filing and renewal filings in Minnesota. Finally, I'll note that our Business Services Division has implemented two new programs enacted by the legislature just in the past year. Thank you for that, members. The first is a new system allowing for the prevention of bogus filings, often used to harass individuals, including public officials and including some state legislators. The system allows the office to reject, with a method of appeal, any facially fraudulent filing and also provides a mechanism for individuals to identify a fraudulent filing. The second program that's new that you who were here last year enacted is a key part of the new structured settlement law. You may recall this from last year. Our office provides for the filing of structured settlement purchasing companies, including a sworn certification of a surety bond. I'm proud of the business services division of our office and the employees who work very hard to ensure that starting and maintaining a business in Minnesota is made easier and not more challenging by our office. Because of this work, as I mentioned, the Office of Secretary of State is a net contributor of $27 million to the general fund each biennium. And to put that in further context, our general fund appropriation for the current biennium is a bit over $14 million. So it's $14 million that we ask for, and we make, in addition to that, $27 million for the state. Moving on to elections, and I know that this isn't generally the purview of this committee, but I thought that the committee would want a general understanding about how that piece fits into the whole. We maintain secure and clean elections here in Minnesota, and we do that while maintaining high voter participation. We've made important investments in democracy over the years, both in terms of laws and financial contributions. But there is a lot more to do to keep Minnesota at the top of every good elections list. We have to keep investing in our democracy. I'm committed to working with anyone in this committee or anyone in Minnesota, regardless of political party, regardless of zip code, regardless of background, to make sure we can be on the same page there and strengthen our democracy for the benefit of the voters. Our office works, as many of you know, with counties, cities, and townships to put on our elections. Our office operates and maintains the statewide voter registration system, or SVRS, which is the main database of all Minnesota voters and really the backbone of our election system. The election division in my office certifies voting systems, accepts candidate filings for federal and state offices, trains local election officials, and conducts most recounts. Just to give you some context, there are more than 2,000 township elections annually, 900 city elections on a two-year cycle, 300 school district elections on a two-year cycle, and 20 other elections on a two-year cycle. That's a lot of elections, especially when only 9 counties in Minnesota have full-time staff dedicated only to elections year-round. And I like to point this out, and many of you from Greater Minnesota know this, and thank you for allying with our office in educating others around the legislature and around the state about that. That's a statistic I like to talk about. Some people, when they think of elections and their counties, they're envisioning, because that's where they live, a full-time, year-round election staff. Hennepin, where I live, has that. Ramsey has that. Washington has that. In fact, Ms. Freeman, before she came to our office, ran elections in Washington County. She was the chief election administrator in Washington County. But as many of you from Greater Minnesota know, in most of the rest of the state, overwhelmingly, that's not the case. The person, typically the county auditor or the auditor treasurer, who's in charge of elections, is also in charge of, say, property taxes or ditch and drainage work or public housing or inspections of some kind. So I think that's important context when we're passing laws and discussing bills to understand just that piece of how it works differently in different parts of Minnesota. Our work goes far beyond the high-profile statewide and congressional elections to which people pay the most attention, of course. Relatively new to the office is an elections cyber navigator, or really security navigator, program. These two staff members, funded by Help America Vote Act funds from the federal government, are tasked with working with all 87 counties to help secure our election system. Our office also administers millions of dollars in grants and reimbursements to local governments. Since 2017, our office has administered nearly $30 million in state and federal grant or reimbursement funds. To put the growth of this work in context, between 2011 and 2017, the office processed less than $1 million in grants and reimbursements to locals. And these are important resources for local governments, but the work in administering these grants and reimbursements has placed a significant strain on our staff. We do have one full-time voter outreach staff member and one temporary voter outreach staff member supporting an important component of the work of our office. Our small team hires temporary staff to staff a voter hotline for voters in the weeks before the election. This past election, they handled about 8,000 calls from voters all over the state seeking information from our office. In the past two general elections, this team has worked with the State Commission on Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing to establish what we believe is the nation's first American Sign Language call center for those who are hearing impaired. This team does elections 101 training for nonprofits, corporations, schools, community organizations, and others to ensure that individuals understand our election system and how to access it. They do written fact sheets. They have a policy providing these materials in 11 languages to ensure that individuals can access this information in the language most comfortable to them. And while I understand that this isn't an elections policy committee, I just wanted to have some numbers as it relates to the 2022 elections. And one important one that I want to draw your attention to is the number of people it takes to run an election. And some of you know this maybe from personal experience or just because you know your districts, but it takes about 30,000 election judges, 30,000 people every election cycle to put on an election. These are people who stand up and step up. There is a small stipend, so it's not a volunteer job, but they don't do it to get rich. We need 30,000 people every cycle to stand up and do this job. And these are our friends and neighbors. These are people who are stepping forward because it's a community service, and they, it's a glimpse on the front, into the front lines of our election system. Next, Madam Chair and members, I'll touch briefly on the work of the administration division of our office. The administration division administers the open appointments process for approximately 230 boards, councils, agencies, task forces, and commissions. It certifies official documents and maintains the original chapter laws and files thousands of official documents each year. As Secretary of State, I also serve on the Executive Council and on the State Board of Investment. In addition to carrying out those constitutionally mandated responsibilities, the administration division also serves as constituent services, working with the state, federal, and local election officials and their constituents. Finally, last but not least, certainly is the Safe at Home division of our office, which provides an address confidentiality service to Minnesotans who fear for their safety. Safe at Home was enacted by the legislature in 2006. It protects victims of assault, stalking, or sexual violence, typically by providing services that allow the participants to live safely and securely at a private address that is not disclosed to those in the public or private sector. This is done first and foremost by providing an address that participants can use for all purposes, including legal services. It's typically a P.O. box in St. Paul, no matter where they live in the state, with a unique lot number. We partner with victim advocates serving all 87 counties in the state, and these victim advocates complete the enrollment applications with each potential participant. Participation has increased in the Safe at Home program from less than 200 in its first year to serving just under 4,000 active participants in as of December 31st, 2022. And you can see those trend lines there, and I always mention that it's a bittersweet statistic when you see the increase in participation in Safe at Home. By anyone's measure, Safe at Home is a pretty extreme remedy. If things have gotten so bad in a person's life that they need to be in a program where their true home address is literally shielded for all purposes from all people, that's a pretty serious situation. And on the one hand, it's great that that many people, just under 4,000, can take advantage of that kind of service. But on the other hand, it's kind of sad that that many people continue to need, in growing numbers, that kind of service. I think it's important to note that the measure of work for the Safe at Home division is not just measured in active participants, obviously. People come in and out of the program throughout the year for various reasons. Here's a slide here that highlights the total individuals served per calendar year. And as for the types of address confidentiality services provided by the office has grown, notably to include real property transactions, the work of the program has grown significantly as well. I thought you'd want to see, and you can read on your own, obviously, here are just a few. I think we have some quotes from participants that have been collected by our office during the last couple of years during annual surveys. You can read them on your own, but suffice it to say, this is life-saving work that people are eternally grateful for, and it's really a special pride of mine to be involved in this service that really does change lives and in many cases save lives. So, members, I want to thank you for your time. This was a very brief overview. I know you have a time crunch, so I tried to speed things along here. My office is always available to you at any time, and I just want to say, you know, I'll be back to this committee surely, but no matter how many times I'm back, we're in the process now of setting up meetings with all of you, regardless of party, regardless of chamber, everyone who's on any committee that touches our office. And regardless of those formal meetings in your office, I want you to know and feel that you can always get in touch with me. You can reach out to me. You can reach out to Ms. Freeman. You can reach out to Julie Strother, our Deputy Secretary of State, who's here behind me, or anyone in any particular area of our office. We can meet and talk offline. We can text. Anytime you have issues or ideas or concerns, I want to be available to all of you members. So thank you very much, Madam Chair. Happy to stand for questions or not.
Thank you, Secretary of State. I think we have at least three questions. And again, I'll remind the committee, please keep it on the part that's to our jurisdiction. Lead Nash, do you want to go first or last?
I'll go first.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, you and I don't agree on everything, but I wanted to give you a shout out. I have a constituent, or I guess you and I have a shared constituent, who whose husband lost his battle with PTSD and committed suicide, and she needed a document from your office. And I called you late on a Saturday night, and I wanted to commend you for making that appear Monday morning, and I wanted to thank you for that. And again, we don't agree on everything, but I will recognize that you will go to an effort for members who reach out, and I wanted to thank you for that. And then encourage you as you set up meetings with members, pick the Senate last, because even in deference to former Senator Newton, really, who cares? All that in jest. But just again, thanks for that, and look forward to a future presentation.
Thank you, Lead Nash. Next, we have Representative Joy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary, the Safe at Home, where you show the 2018 to 2022 increases, I guess for my sake, I like to digest numbers. Could we get that in a 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 slide? Could we get that just to see how the data increase? I just like to digest numbers. Is that something we possibly could get?
Secretary of State.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Jory, we'd be happy to get you those numbers. Yes.
Thank you.
If you'd provide this to the committee administrator, she will get those out to everyone. Thank you very much. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you very much. And I, too, would like to acknowledge Ms. Freeman's work. We had an issue in my district. A question came up. Important election question on I believe it was the day of the election or just before, and we got some good response, so I appreciate your willingness to take my call and help us clarify exactly what was going on. But in regards to the Safe at Home program, you know, is 9% of your budget, how did that end up in the Secretary of State's purview and maybe not the Attorney General's office in terms of protection and more of a legalistic type of protection that people are seeking? If you could clarify that for me, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Secretary of State.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kosnick, great question. I get that a lot. I can totally understand how someone would say, wait a minute, great program, but why is that with you? It sounds like kind of a law enforcement thing. And the answer is there are now 38 states that have an address confidentiality program. Many of them go by the name Safe at Home, not all. Most are in offices of Secretary of State, but not all. In some states, they're in the Attorney General's office. In some states, they're a free-floating, independent program. But to answer your direct question, Representative, it really has to do with the very first state, which was Washington State in 1991. And what they found is, unfortunately, enterprising, clever abusers were using the public voting rolls as the method to find people who didn't want to be found. So it sort of snowballed from there, and it became a priority of that Office of Secretary of State. And then other secretaries of state around the country decided to do the same thing we did in 2006. But that's the short answer to your question. And as I say, the majority are with secretaries of state in other states, but not all.
Thank you, Secretary of State.
Okay.
Thank you. And we appreciate all of the work that you do, both of you, Ms. Freeman and Secretary of State Simon. Thank you for your presentation today, and we'll look forward to your budget requests later this year.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, and have a great day. Next, we have on our agenda House File 48, Representative Richardson. And Representative Richardson, since you are not a member of this committee, I will move House File 48 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. And that way we'll have the bill before us. So that motion is now before us. Would you like to introduce your bill, please, Representative Richardson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 48 would clarify that Juneteenth, which is celebrated June 19th and is recognized as an official federal holiday, is also an official state holiday. It would also modify in statute that the day of recognition of Juneteenth would fall on June 19th annually rather than the third Saturday of the month as currently provided in state statute. Some are under the mistaken impression that the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863 ended the brutal institution of slavery. However, as the Civil War ended, there were still thousands of black people who remained enslaved. It is a reality of the legacy of this country of delaying freedom for black people. In Minnesota and across the U.S., July 4th is celebrated as Independence Day. It's about freedom, it's about liberty, but it's also about an imperfect freedom because slavery legally existed in this nation. To be clear, black enslaved men contributed to the independence of our nation and fought in the Revolutionary War. Abolitionist Frederick Douglass pointed out the paradox of this imperfect freedom in his July 5th, 1852 speech. What to a slave is the 4th of July? He answered, "I say it with a sad sense of the disparity between us. I'm not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not me." The celebration of Juneteenth provides space for all of us to reflect on a more inclusive definition of freedom. The end of chattel slavery in this country is an important milestone worthy of recognition and worthy of celebration. And it's a step in the right direction of truly living up to the promise of this nation that all are created equal. It's an opportunity to acknowledge how far we've come and how far we have to go. It's not lost on me that this hearing is occurring the day after the celebration of Martin Luther King Jr. It's also not lost on me that when Dr. King was brutally assassinated in cold blood, 75% of Americans disapproved of him. And following his death, a third of people believed he brought his murder on himself. And less than 50% were sad about his assassination. Attempts to honor Dr. King with the holiday began in earnest in 1968, and it was not until 1983 that his birthday was recognized, and not until 2000 that all states declared MLK Day a state holiday. The recognition was long overdue, and the recognition of Juneteenth is also overdue. Before I yield my time, I want to take a moment to lift up and recognize the late Minnesota State Representative Richard Jefferson, who passed away at the age of 90 in 2019. He began this conversation back in 1996 in the Minnesota House and brought more attention to Juneteenth decades before federal recognition of this holiday. Through the bill he offered, he made Minnesota the fourth state in the nation to recognize Juneteenth. His colleagues in the legislature unanimously supported his efforts recognizing the importance. With that, Madam Chair, I do have a testifier appearing with me that I would yield my time to.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. And we have with us today Mr. Lee Jordan.
Yes, ma'am.
If you would please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Lee Jordan. I'm the Midwestern State Director for the National Juneteenth. And I am honored to be here to speak to you all. I have been a part of Juneteenth since about 1989. And it has been my pleasure and my honor to make sure we talk about the history of Juneteenth and not the fact that it's just a story in Galveston, Texas, but it's the story of America. Because we are not talking about African-American history, we are talking about American history. And it's important to also know that one of when we talk about Martin Luther King, the fact that one of his marches was actually on the 19th of June. So that date is a very, very important date within the community. And yes, I am a descendant of the survivors of slavery. And to me, that is a big part of what Juneteenth is supposed to be about. The history itself, not to talk about what was done to us, but to talk about how we can get past it. So please, I'd love to see you all at a Juneteenth. And if you need a Juneteenth calendar, I can take an order for 23 or 2024. So please reach out to me.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. And we would just like to say it's wonderful to have you here with us today. Thank you. I'm not aware of any amendments to the bill. Is there any discussion to House File 48? Representative Cousin.
Thank you. And Representative Richards, I appreciate your efforts on this. You had mentioned that this is a legacy of our country, and I, as born in Colombia, I had the opportunity a couple years back to visit parts of the country, and one of them was Cartagena, and it was kind of chilling to be in the port where slaves came. And so it's, to me, I'll be supporting your bill, and it's important to acknowledge, you know, worldwide the slavery trade and the atrocity that it was. So I appreciate you sharing and informing the rest of the legislature on your efforts here. And thank you, sir, Mr. Jordan, for being here with us and for your efforts.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Any further statements or comments? All right. In that case, hearing none, I renew my motion. Oh, I'm sorry. Would you like closing comments?
No, I'm doing just fine. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you so much. Hearing none, I renew my motion to recommend House File 48 to be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Say nay. Hearing none, the ayes have it. And with that, House File 48 is recommended to be placed on the General Register. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we will have a presentation by the Minnesota Humanities Center. And with that, we have with us Kevin Lindsay. I'd like to remind the members there is a packet, there is a handout in your packet if you wish to follow along. And with heartfelt thanks, I welcome you to the committee today. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Kevin Lindsay. My name is spelled K-E-V-I-N. Last name is L-I-N-D-S-E-Y. And I have the pleasure of serving as the CEO of the Minnesota Humanities Center. And I appreciate this opportunity to discuss and provide an overview of the Minnesota Humanities Center. We're organized as a nonprofit organization. We're located on the east side of St. Paul at 987 Ivy Avenue in the building which is depicted on the first slide in your packet. Our historic building was used as a school within the old Children Gillette Hospital campus, and it was the last building in the state of Minnesota to serve children with the disease of polio. If you go to slide 2, talk briefly about the National Endowment for the Humanities, the federal administrative agency, which has been in existence for slightly more than 50 years. In the enabling legislation of the NEH, it provides that democracy demands the wisdom of its citizens. The NEH website notes that it seeks to serve and strengthen our democratic republic by promoting excellence in the humanities and conveying the history lessons to all Americans. The humanities are defined in the dictionary as the academic disciplines that study the aspects of being human, such as art, language, religion, philosophy, political science, civics, jurisprudence, and history. Personally, I like to think of the humanities as the stories that we tell ourselves and one another to help us understand ourselves, our communities, and our world. The NEH has an affiliate in each state and 4 out of the 6 territories of the United States. Minnesota is one of the first 8 states in the country to serve as an affiliate to the National Endowment in Humanities. And that began in 1971. The writer William Faulkner reminds us that the past is never dead. It's not even past. Accordingly, we seek to provide programming that helps us as a society better understand how our past impacts our present, with the hope that the shared understanding among us will be increased and conditions will be ripe for us to build a strong collective future together, seeking to build upon the promise of our democracy. Our vision, what we seek to accomplish, a curious society in which we listen to one another with open hearts and open minds, where we authentically listen to one another, a connected society in which Dr. King reminds us that we are intertwined in a garment of mutual destiny. What impacts one impacts the other. A compassionate society in which people move beyond empathy toward action. Because our time is limited, I'll go to slide 3. I won't identify all of the items which are identified there, but I will provide a broad overview of the 4 areas. In the area of education, we provide educator institutes, workshops. We work with teachers and professors in colleges to provide written materials to support K-12 instruction as well as university instruction. Recently, we have been in partnership with Ball State and Lakeland College in Florida for a project called Third Way Civics, in which it seeks to provide civics instructions, although there are no red or blue colleges. We seek to provide Third Way Civics in a manner in which we can provide a framework of vision for how civics can be taught within colleges that is acceptable to all. We're excited about this work, and there are various schools at the high school level that are adopting it. In the area of civics, we seek to provide programs to help people understand our political history, our political system, and how to engage in others in a civil manner. Immersive. We seek to create programs and offerings that explore the rich tapestry of the many diverse cultural communities that exist within the state of Minnesota. And I know that some of you serve on our state ethnic councils, such as Representative Nash, and I appreciate your involvement and others' involvement on this respective committee within that space. I had an opportunity to be in Rochester yesterday giving a Dr. King speech, and it was beautiful to see the many people from the many different cultures in that room together talking about how they wish to create the beloved community. I think there is important work for us to be done and continue within this, and we're very proud to play a small part as a Minnesota Humanities Center in creating that tapestry. We also provide programs that explore the veterans' experience, the experience of the loved ones of veterans, the experience of refugees fleeing war, and broader issues such as civilian control over the military. The Minnesota Humanities Center has been recognized among state humanities councils across the country for its leadership in this area of providing veterans programming. We thank you for your past support within that space. Go to slide 4 within your packet. The Minnesota Humanities Center also administers grants when it provides funding from the Minnesota Legislature, when it gets funding from the Minnesota Legislature or from the National Endowment for the Humanities. The funding provided to MHC provides grants that are very key, I would say, in the ecosystem of humanities programming. And I say that because the majority of grants provided by MHC end up in the hands of small organizations and individuals who are often sometimes overlooked by large foundations within our state. We provide that bridge, that gap for these individuals and small organizations. Current biennium, the Minnesota Legislature provide cultural heritage grants. We're very proud to be able to administer more than 100 grants across the state. And in your packet, there is a map which indicates that reach. We go to slide 5. Building that I talked about earlier also serves as an event center. It's primarily used by nonprofit organizations, educational entities, and governmental entities. Several state task forces have used our office and our retreat center, such as Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women, and as I should note with Representative Richardson, also Murdered and Missing Black Women. In the past 3 years, MHC has been recognized with its work. The Schwartz Prize, which is the top award from the Federation of State Humanities Councils, which is the second time that that has happened for us. We've also received a History and Progress Award, in which we explore the connection between the horrible incident of the lynching in Duluth in 1919 to the connection to the death of Mr. George Floyd, seeking to provide a pathway forward, not to be stuck into the past, but how do we create a better democracy, a better vision for us all. We've also received a Diversity and Inclusion Award from the Minnesota Lawyer Organization. I want to thank you for this opportunity this morning to provide you with an overview of the work of the Minnesota Humanities Center. I look forward to the questions that you have or not have, but more importantly, I look to working with you going forward to build a better, stronger, more inclusive Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindsay. Are there any questions from the committee members? Thank you so much for your time, and we appreciate your presentation today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Committee, our work is completed for the day. Our next meeting will be Thursday, January 19th, and this meeting is adjourned.